Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And we've got a bit of a kind of a welcome return this week to looking at, obviously, one of the books that we've spent most time in the last few years examining, which is Everyday Stalinism by Sheila Fitzpatrick. Now, full admission here, the reason why we haven't had this for quite a long time is because it was lost. My copy was hidden in some deep recess of my vast archive of history books. But hey, here we are. So last time we got towards the end of the book, and we were looking at the beginnings of the Great Terror of the late 1930s. And here we're going to look at the almost the kind of the social aspect of the Great Terror. As in all periods of state violence, there are a lot of kind of everyday participants, you know, the pointers of fingers, the denouncers, who are participants or victims or swept along with things or simply witnesses. Okay, so Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, "In the terror of 1937, there was a clear sense that enemies of the people were likely to be found in the elites, especially communist administrators. But enemies might be found anywhere. Even within the elites, there were no clear guidelines as to which persons needed to be unmasked. Of course, someone with black marks on his record, past oppositionism, bad social origins, foreign connections, was particularly at risk, and prepared lists of victims played a role in the Great Purges. But there was a large element of randomness in the selection process too. Finger-pointing at self-criticism meetings in offices and enterprises, public accusations in newspapers, and private denunciation by citizens were among the selection mechanisms. Chains of association were also very important too. The NKVD would pull in one person and interrogate them, asking them to name his criminal associates. When he finally broke down and named some names, they would be pulled in. And the process continued. when anyone was arrested as an enemy of the people, family, friends and work associates all became high-risk candidates. Okay, so there's a lot to kind of unpack there. List making was a significant factor because of the bureaucratic nature of Soviet society, meant that there were lists of people, censuses and card indexes and vast reams of data on people all over the place. The thing that the Bolsheviks had and the Stalinists had excelled in was creating this very sort of hesitate to use the word data rich because a lot of it was wildly inaccurate, but this kind of paper trail society it was partly something inherited from the Third Section and the Okhrana, who were great keepers of files on subversive times, but rolled out to huge swathes of society. If you wanted to start looking for enemies, you didn't have to do it on the streets. You did it in the archives. However, the randomness is a really important point. When you get public buy-in and participation, and this is something that isn't really said enough about the purges, is that they were a kind of a mass participation process. And that, as with denunciation under the Nazi regime, there were citizens who believed they were doing the right thing and that they were suspicious, unpatriotic or anti-revolutionary or dangerous types next door, and we've been keeping an eye on them. And it was a way of sometimes even being rewarded by the regime. So though there were plenty of denouncers themselves who wound up in the gulags or in front of the firing squad. One of the key processes, writes Sheila Fitzpatrick, of terror in the Great Purges, particularly in the first half of 1937, was public scapegoating. This took place at meetings at the workplace, whose function was to draw conclusions from some signal from above. For example, the Piatakov trial, or the February to March plenum of the Central Committee. There would be a report explaining the significance of the signal, followed by a collective discussion on the conclusions that should be drawn. This was a well-established Soviet practice, but in the context of terror, it acquired a new purpose. Drawing conclusions came to mean pointing the finger at hidden enemies within the institution. So in factories across the Soviet Union, following the trial and sentencing of Piatakov, or, you know, Bukharin or Zinoviev or whoever, a question in a factory in Kursk or Chelyabinsk or somewhere like that would be, well, who are his supporters here? Well, I heard comrade so-and-so had expressed sympathies towards his point of view. Or what has gone wrong here? Well, I think that there has been, you know, there was a breakage on the production line. Well, that was very probably sabotage, and probably the Piatakov element has been causing trouble. Well, who do we think is in the element? Well, I think it's comrade so and so, and is that kind of thing. And there were, the reason why we call it signals from above is because there would be party bosses and factory bosses looking at things like the Piatakov trial and thinking, well, what is comrade Stalin trying to tell me is the right thing to do here? And if I do it, what kind of advancement will I get? Ah, right, well, he's clearly demonstrating people with these sorts of views and sympathies are the enemies now. Well, you know, I'd better do my bit here and root them out. These meetings were sometimes described as criticism and self-criticism sessions. This is obviously something that Mao picks up and runs with after 1949. But self-criticism was really a misnomer. Apologies and recantations by individuals occurred, though they rarely affected the outcome. But the drama of the occasion lay elsewhere. The institution, not the individual, was the subject of self-criticism. The point of criticism and self-criticism, Great Purges style, was collective discovery of a hidden enemy within the ranks. usually one of the leaders of the institution. The outcome was not generally predetermined. The implicit requirement was that a scapegoat should be found, and that he should not be an insignificant person when the institution could easily the institution could easily sacrifice. Tension could mount intolerably in these sessions just because of the uncertainty about who the ultimate victims would be. Why do we need, under Stalinist conditions, to be finding hidden enemies? Well, because this is the underlying narrative of the entire regime. The Stalinist regime said, well, we're surrounded. There are capitalist powers all around us and their little lackeys, places like Poland and Germany and Japan on our borders. And you know, they're going to get us one fine day. They've invaded us during the First World War and then during the Russian Civil War, and you know, we need to be building up the Soviet state. We need to be arming it, and this is why I'm having these 5-year plans. But there are all these enemies in our midst, and they look like us. They walk amongst us. Some of them even pretend to talk like us. They've infiltrated the party that well. There are people who claim that they are revolutionary and they're not. And you need to look behind the mask. And this was the language that Stalin used during collectivization. He basically said this of the kulaks. He said, you know, they at first glance, they sort of look like Soviet citizens, but they're not really. Deep inside their minds, those the little capitalists trying to get out, and what they all the things they do to cause ruin and in the country, and you know, prevent food from getting to the cities. That's all sabotage. I mean, part of it is the personal paranoid thinking of Stalin, but it's very difficult to explain structural things, big structural changes, by looking at personalities alone. In some ways, it's a shared ideological position, which has some basis in truth. I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, the Soviet Union pretty much is surrounded by hostile capitalist powers, and no doubt there were all sorts of people opposed to the Soviet Union crossing over its very porous borders. But for the most part, the peoples targeted in the purges had absolutely nothing to do with any of this, and or the stories of vast conspiratorial networks are kind of the works of collective fevered imaginings. Sheila Fitzpatrick writes, one model for this form of scapegoating came out of the Stakhanovite movement. If you remember when we talked about Stakhanovites a long, long time ago now, these were the model workers, people who were able to who are able to fulfill vast work quotas and even kind of go beyond those, and they were kind of held up as the kind of the model for the other workers to emulate. One model for this form of scapegoating came out of the Stakhanovite movement, which in 1936 had developed a strong anti-management overtones. With Stakhanovites in local management collectives taking a lead in denouncing managers and wreckers and saboteurs as wreckers and saboteurs. A secret instruction from the Politburo in early 1937 instructed factory managers to hold monthly meetings with Stakhanovite workers so that Stakhanovites could vent their criticisms and accusations. The newspapers reported dramatic occasions when workers hurled abuse at unpopular managers. The epithets Goebbels, bureaucratic barbarians and donkey's ears were used at one meeting. But this zest for denunciation was not universal. In some plants, it seems workers grew weary of giving up their free time to wrestle with the question of which of their managers were wreckers. We know of several cases where workers tried to short-circuit the process by simply nominating a list of candidates for wrecker status and voting to approve it. Another scapegoating mechanism was the re-election of party officers called for in the name of party democracy at the February-March plenum of the Central Committee. The label sounded innocuous, but every party secretary present must have recognised it as part of the complex of threats to his security that were offered on that occasion. It must be remembered that in normal circumstances, party democracy, like Soviet democracy, existed only as a fiction. The convention in both contexts was that elections were essentially uncontested. The candidates were nominated according to lists sent down from a higher authority, which were then duly confirmed by voting. When it became clear in the spring of 1937 that party elections under the rubric of party democracy meant that there would be no lists, that there was that was a major shock and not a welcome one. On what basis were candidates for party office to be selected if the central party organs refused to indicate whom they favoured? In a context where more communist officials were being unmasked as enemies of the people every day, how could one avoid the ultimate horror of electing someone who had turned out to be an enemy, which meant showing oneself to be an enemy by association? The party elections proceeded slowly and with great difficulty. In the absence of lists, each candidate had to be discussed individually, and presumption was that at least some of the candidates, notably those who were incumbents, would be unmasked as enemies in the course of the discussion.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The incumbent officers were understandably intimidated and paralysed. The rank and file often showed little inclination to take initiative into their own hands. Sometimes there was difficulty getting the show off the ground at all, because nobody wanted to speak. Some elections lasted for weeks. At one, Yaroslav Plant, for example. The 800 members of the factory party organisation attended meetings every evening for more than a month before they managed to elect a new committee. So, this is really interesting. The purpose of this kind of mass party democracy was to do nothing more than to create this pantomime, this theatre, by which the process of denunciation could occur. If you're trying to decide who should be elected, and you have a list of candidates chosen from above, of which some will always be denounced, you have to be the very sort of incisive electorate, a very incisive worker who picks the one who is kind of future-proofed. If you choose somebody who is later denounced, you will be denounced yourself. So these were kind of scary and dangerous times. And it's hardly surprising you have workers taking sometimes months to decide and perhaps to wait for the denunciations to actually have already happened. The party elections were no simple matter in the Ministry of Heavy Industry, writes Sheila Fitzpatrick, where it took a week of careful weighing of 80 candidacies to produce a list of 11 names. Some candidates were discredited in the course of the discussion, among them the incumbent party secretary Andrei Zaykov, who was alleged to have contacts with Trotskyite counter-revolutionaries and to have participated in a leftist group at the Institute of Red Professors in 1928-29. When Zaykov failed to win re-election, that did not just mean he lost his job, but also that he was in acute danger of being arrested as a counter-revolutionary, which indeed was his fate. The same fate awaited others criticised at the prolonged meetings of them at the ministry. For example, Georgi Givakaya, head of the Makiva metallurgical plant, whose definitive unmasking as an enemy came only a few weeks after he'd been worked over in this forum. So, once the kind of the theatre had happened, and the accusations had been presented, and people had been it's almost like a kind of little workplace show trial in a way. It might take a while after that for actually the NKVD to turn up and do the arrest or the actual official legal charges to be made, because throughout all of this there is a kind of a juridical process. There is a kind of a legal system still operating where people are charged with crimes. The trial might be a farce, but it still goes ahead in most cases, and except later on in the terror, when the numbers of executions have to happen as dictated by Stalin make that kind of an impracticality. The party elections of the spring of 1937 were a one-shot event. But other kinds of electoral meetings were held periodically during the Great Purges, and on these occasions were often perilous for the nominees. In January 1938, for example, writes Sheila Fitzpatrick, the Trade Union of Government Employees held its national conference and, according to the rules, proceeded to elect a new central committee of the union. Whether a list of candidates had been provided for this election or not is not clear from the minutes of the conference. Most likely it was, but in the climate of the Great Purges, that did not prejudge the outcome. Each candidate was required to make an autobiographical statement to the conference, and delegates cross-examined them on it. In a series of meetings that grew increasingly tense, delegates savaged several members of the old committee who had been nominated, causing two of them to be knocked off the list, and cross-examined other candidates in an aggressive and threatening way about their civil war military records, social origin, Kulak connections, and so on. The scapegoating instincts of the delegates fastened on one hapless woman with relatives abroad and a failed marriage she was unwilling to discuss. She escaped being dropped from the list and declared an enemy of the people, only through the dramatic last-minute intervention by a senior delegate. Regional and other family circles had their own tried and tested methods of defending members from outside threat. By family circles, these are the families of people in power and their kind of network of friends. There's a BLAT network of hangers-on and people who are who owe them and people who they are loyal to. Indeed, this was one of the main purposes of their existence. Thus, in response to the threats to individual family members early in 1937, the heads of the families, industrial managers, regional party secretaries, sprang to defensive action. For example, the head of a metal trust let some subordinates go at their own request when the heat got too great, and moved others to new jobs in different cities where they would be safer. Another industrial leader let his right-hand man be prosecuted for sabotage after a bad accident, but at the same time gave him 12,000 rubles for his legal defence. Yet another, a regional representative of the Ministry of Heavy Industry, tried to rescue a disgraced factory director by appointing him as his assistant. In Sverdlovsk, the party committee rallied to the support of the director of a local plant when he came under attack as a wrecker and blocked his expulsion from the party. In the Far East, regional officials resisted attempts to expel one of their own, Marvai Kvakin, who was secretary of the Jewish Autonomous Region, Birobidzhan. When it became clear that Kvakin could not be saved by action at the regional level, his friends encouraged him to go to Moscow to plead his case, gave him 5,500 rubles from party funds for the purpose of issuing him a pass that secured him a place on a Moscow train. This is really interesting, and it shows you, when we talk about everyday Stalinism, as in, you know, the title of the book, and the how society functions under the conditions of totalitarian rule. The point is that society is still there. I mean, it's profoundly affected by totalitarian rule, but it doesn't go away. There are people who have friendships under the terror. There are people who, I suppose, are loyal to one another under the terror. There are family connections where people love one another under conditions of terror. And there were still people, you know, party bosses, factory managers, who had a little bit of agency. They could be listened to, and they had a little bit of sway, and they could commandeer a little bit of money here and there. They could give people jobs when it was needed. They could move people around when it was needed. They understood the system that they existed under. They knew it was very, very dangerous, and many probably assumed that that they might be denounced themselves at some point in the future. But this is part of how people try to endure and prosper, if possible, under extraordinary and monstrous events. And you find it in all sorts of different totalitarian societies. People have agency. There we go. Okay, folks, so I'll try to get another podcast in before Christmas, but if not, I wish you all a very lovely, happy, relaxing Christmas period, and we're going to be back with some really cool stuff in 2023. Take good care, everybody. All the best. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks so much for helping us over these 10 long years of podcasting. Take care. All the best. Bye-bye.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.